Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from The James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. President Trump promised a long speech because he said he had a lot to say. And that promise became a reality last night. The State of the Union address lasted nearly 2 hours, a record 1 hour and 47 minutes, the longest State of the Union address ever. It began with President Trump saying our nation is back, bigger, better, and stronger than ever. He talked about tariffs and health care. It took him more than an hour to bring up Iran. And the speech ended with the awarding of Congressional Medals of Honor. We're going to analyze the speech and talk about what things that were said mean for the upcoming midterm elections. Joining us for our analysis today, we have Paul Beck, political science professor emeritus from Ohio State University. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thank you.
And we also have Brianna Mack, associate professor of politics and government from Ohio Wesleyan University. Welcome to the show, Brianna.
Happy to be here.
So the tone of President Trump's speech, the tone he wanted to set, was set from the very beginning with this.
Our country is winning again. In fact, we're winning so much that we really don't know what to do about it. People are asking me, please, 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 Mr. President, we're winning too much. We can't take it anymore. We're not used to winning in our country. Until you came along, we're just always losing, but now we're winning too much. And I say, no, 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 you're going to win again. You're going to win big. You're going to win bigger than ever. And to prove that point, here with us tonight is a group of winners who just made the entire nation proud. The men's gold medal Olympic hockey team. Come on in.
So, Paul Beck, what about the overall tone of the speech? Was it a gold medal speech?
Well, I wouldn't classify it as a gold medal speech, and I don't think his speeches ever are. Mm. It was sort of a curious mix of statements that he would claim to be facts about the achievements of the administration in the first year, and they will be fact-checked, and then a series of plaudits to individuals, making of awards and so forth and so on, maybe designed to humanize him more than he typically is. It would be interesting to see, and I don't have it, the actual script.
Mm.
And they do distribute a script ahead of time. Now, how complete it is, I don't know. I've never seen it before. But, my sense is that he was less on a roll last night than he normally is.
Mm.
And maybe that was by design, because the people who are scripting the speech didn't want it to seem as negative as it often is.
Hmm. So they told him to read the script, sir.
they did. Now, I think he can't do that very easily. And, mm-hmm. Most speakers can't.
Mm-hmm.
And plenty of presidents, when they deliver a State of the Union address, of course, are going to talk about their achievements. So there's a lot of bragging going on up front, and his is more fact-checkable than a lot of others. One thing that came to mind immediately when he was talking about inflation, that it's the lowest ever, and of course it's not. I'm old enough to remember the stagflation period of the late 1970s and early 1980s, and there have been other times as well. So the fact-checkers will have a field day. With this. It may not matter because his base doesn't care so much about that, but we'll see.
All right, Brianna, Trump said we're entering a golden age of America, and to go with that, he had all of those gold medal winning people from the men's hockey team. Did that gold medal, golden age, did that message stick through going forward throughout the whole speech to you?
I don't think so. So when I was watching the address last night and, he was bringing out all of these people and passing out all of these awards, it reminded me of daytime talk shows. Like all I could think about was Oprah telling people, you get a car, you get a car, everyone gets a car. Because after a while, that's what essentially was going on. He was passing out medals and shouting out people, using them to introduce different types of programs that seemed like just came into existence within the last 72 hours. And so after a while, like, even though it's the longest speech ever in history, I feel like once you take away all of the applause and once you take away all the giveaways, I feel like he only talked for maybe an hour.
Okay. That's interesting. Yeah. If you he even gave a special award to the goalie for the U.S. Olympic team. I mean, everyone got an award, right?
Like, he was the goalie. And yes, you know, goalies are important. I was a goalkeeper when I played soccer, but I didn't realize if I had kept at it that maybe, just maybe, I could have received a medal from the president. That was missed opportunity.
Missed opportunity, yeah. And, okay, so more than 30 Democrats skipped the address. And there was a lot of shouting back and forth between the president and the Democrats in the room. Paul Beck, what did you think of that part of the night, the fighting between the president and some of the Democrats?
Well, I think the Democrats were asked by their leaders to try to tone down their negative reactions to the speech.
Last year they had, do you remember they had paddles that they held up where I don't remember what the paddle said. Did it say like lie or something? Like
Yes.
Okay. So there were no paddles this time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So do you think they were asked to tone it down?
Oh, I think they definitely were, and the leadership said that.
Why?
Well, I think you want to make it more of a speech about the president and reactions about the president than you want to make it this kind of tedious back and forth.
You can't get him riled up if you don't give him something.
Exactly.
Okay, exactly. I see. The most heated exchange was when he asked elected officials to stand up if they believe the first duty of an elected official is to protect American citizens and not illegal aliens. And the Democratic side of the room did not stand up, and he pointed that out. President Trump pointed that out. There was a lot of yelling back and forth. Brianna, what did you think he was trying to accomplish there with that actual call out for them to stand up?
I think it was a catch-22, right? So if the Democrats stood up, it would show voters in the audience that, you know, the Democrats actually agree with the president, which would, you know, confuse voters. But then on the other end, them not getting up also confirmed to voters in the audience that what he is saying, you know, is true, that they are prioritizing the undocumented people before regular citizens. But I believe that that was still a gross mistake on part of the Democrats. Like, they could have actually stood up and booed. And so, like, between their decisions to remain seated, as well as now learning that they've received information from the higher-ups to remain more so muted in their opposition, they're not ever going to shake off the allegations of being controlled opposition, which is something that, you know, a lot of Americans feel that, you know, the Democrats aren't doing enough.
Yeah, Paul Beck, what do you think of that? Were they backed into a corner there, a bad position, whether they stood up or didn't stand up?
Yeah, I think it's a hard call to make. And it depends, of course, on what part of the audience you're speaking to. I think that most Democrats are angry with this administration. No matter what Trump was to say, they're going to take issue with it. That was not going to change regardless of how they were instructed to react. On the other hand, I think that the leadership at least felt, not all of the leadership, but most of the Democratic leadership, felt that they really shouldn't appear to be totally impolite. It is the president's address, after all. And I think that was achieved last night.
Mm. Yeah, well, part of that exchange and the shouting, there were two representatives, one of which from Minnesota, who basically stayed seated and shouted back, "You killed Americans in Minnesota," related to the two people who were killed by ICE. So they didn't stay silent, but the fact that the president leaned into the fact, like, well, they're not standing up. I'm seeing that clip playing over and over and over again throughout the whole midterms. Are you, Brianna?
I can see it being played over and over. And so I think, if I recall correctly, that was Ilhan Omar that was shouting back that perhaps whoever her Republican challenger is going to be, I can see them using that clip against her.
Mm. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about last night's State of the Union address with Brianna Mack, Associate Professor of Politics and Government from Ohio Wesleyan University, and Ohio State University Political Science Professor Emeritus Paul Beck. President Trump did address tariffs and talked about how the U.S. Supreme Court recently struck down his tariff policy. And he said he's going to keep the tariffs and he plans to go about it a different way. Let's listen.
Knowing that the legal power that I, as president, have to make a new deal could be far worse for them, and therefore they will continue to work along the same successful path that we had negotiated before the Supreme Court's unfortunate involvement. So despite the disappointing ruling, these powerful country saving, it's saving our country, the kind of money we're taking in, peace protecting. Many of the wars I settled was because of the threat of tariffs. I wouldn't have been able to settle them without. Will remain in place under fully approved and tested alternative legal statutes. And they have been tested for a long time. They're a little more complex, but they're actually probably better, leading to a solution that will be even stronger than before. Congressional action will not be necessary. It's already time-tested and approved. And as time goes by, I believe the tariffs paid for by foreign countries will, like in the past, substantially replace the modern-day system of income tax, taking a great financial burden off the people that I love.
All right, there's a lot to unpack in there. But let's start with, before we talk about getting rid of income taxes, let's start with that alternative legal status that he mentioned, because Baalbek, what do you think he means? There's a way to still do what he wants that's different from what the Supreme Court just ruled on.
Well, I think he will try.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other provisions in the code that seem to allow something by way of tariffs. Whether they need congressional approval or not depends upon the provision in the code. I think he's not going to give up on tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
And I particularly notice that he's not going to give up on other nations paying them,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, is just not true. Mm-hmm. The tariffs are collected at the ports of entry. And they're not collected from these other nations. They're collected from the people who are basically receiving the products, which means they're going to pass along the costs, in many cases, to consumers.
Mm-hmm.
And why he continues that, despite all of the expert opinion on both sides of the aisle, by the way, that tariffs are not a tax on Americans.
Hmm. All right. So, Brianna, the alternative legal statutes aside of however he does this, he's saying that tariffs will replace income tax and take the burden of income tax off of the people he loves. What? How would that work? I mean, it would definitely make tax season a lot simpler if we didn't have to deal with it.
That would be wonderful, right?
Right.
When he said that, the first thing I wrote down was, who are the people that he loves?
Mm.
Because when you're thinking about, on one end, you could be thinking about, oh, it's everybody. It's the everyday average American citizen. But there is enough evidence out there that demonstrates otherwise, that more than likely the people that he loves are super millionaires and, of course, billionaires. And mm-hmm. so clearly, all of these tariffs and even this alternative plan, if he goes with this alternative protocol, it will definitely benefit those individuals more so before it starts to impact or positively benefit you or I.
Mm. Baalbek, can he really get rid of income taxes?
I don't think so, although I think there are a lot of people.
Well, we're trying to do it in Ohio, so
we're trying to do it here. I think there are a lot of people, mainly Republicans, who for years and years and years have opposed the income tax, particularly a progressive income tax that taxes people with higher incomes at higher rates. So that would resonate some, and nobody likes to pay taxes, so it may resonate in a generic sort of way, but it's certainly not realistic to think. And one thing he didn't mention, by the way, is the growing national debt.
Hmm.
And he wasn't going to mention that because it's grown tremendously under his first year as president and the previous 4 years as president. There are some other things that I think are achievements he could take credit for but didn't dwell on, which I think probably was a mistake. But
Well, in the Democratic response, the governor from Virginia called tariffs a tax on the American people. So, Brianna, was that a peek at the midterm elections playbook messaging there, calling tariffs a tax?
I think it could be considered a sneak peek, but I was more so interested in just the ways in which I thought the response was pretty tepid. So, like, while she went in and, you know, outlined her speech with the three questions and was really drilling home that, of course, the answer is no, the president is not working for you, I think that there could have been more said about, I for my students, I always call them shenanigans, but the shenanigans that have happened over the past year in relation to ICE, in relation to the money, and in particular, she missed an opportunity to even talk about the billions that DOGE saved. Where did DOGE go? Where did the DOGE billions and billions go?
Well, I appreciate her keeping her speech to like 14 to 15 minutes. So maybe she just didn't have the time to get into all of that, perhaps. I'm not sure how many people were still awake to watch the Democratic response. I would put myself in the category of barely. All right. Well, coming up, we're going to talk about data centers, which is a growing issue here in Central Ohio. And it came up in last night's State of the Union speech. That is when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. We're talking about the State of the Union address. It was the longest State of the Union speech since anyone's been keeping track of these things. It was 1 hour and 47 minutes. The Democratic response was a little under 15 minutes. And both speeches outlined the plans that both parties have for key talking points for the midterm elections. Still with us for analysis of last night, we have Paul Beck, political science professor emeritus from Ohio State University. Thanks for being here, Paul.
Glad to be here.
And Brianna Mack, associate professor of politics and government from Ohio Wesleyan University. Thanks again for joining us, Brianna.
Happy to be here.
So early on in the speech, the president talked about costs. That's something that impacts everyone. He said that the price of eggs is down 60%. He said rent is lower than it was a year ago. He said even beef prices are coming down. He also mentioned lower gas prices and talked about insanely low gas prices that he saw in Iowa. So, Brianna, do you think the average American at a Kroger or a Giant Eagle on Sunday is going to agree with that, that everything's more affordable?
Absolutely not. So I was speaking with my grandmother just last week, and she was complaining about the price of eggs and saying, I remember when eggs were less than a dollar. And I'm sitting here like, I too can also remember this.
I do. I remember that too. We don't even need your grandma for that.
I know. And so perhaps, you know, it was one of those claims that, you know, while will come off as like a superficial victory, it will in the long run not really stick with voters.
Okay. And Paul Beck, what do you think of him talking about all of the prices being down when most people feel like they aren't down?
Well, that's what people are telling us in polls. They don't feel that they're down. The reason we talk about gas prices is that they are visible. And you drive up and down the street and you'll see different prices posted on different gas stations. So people may have a sense of that, but they have more of a sense of prices at the grocery store, prices that impact them and their families directly. And I think it's going to be very hard to persuade people that prices are down in the first year or first months of the Trump administration.
I mean, I can remember last year at Easter wanting to dye Easter eggs and paying like a lot. I don't know, like maybe $10 for a carton of eggs, because everyone needed, you know, that was the time when the egg prices were all everyone was talking about. And I'm guessing that in a month or so, when I go to buy eggs, they're not going to be $10, right? So maybe they are down 60%, but they're not 99 cents again, to your point, Brianna, right? So, but did he do that? I don't, or was it just, was it bird flu last year that did that to the eggs, you know?
I mean, I think there are a lot of situations at play here. When he mentioned the price of beef, the first thing that I thought about was the whole situation with Argentina. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, yeah, that did happen. And I
only a couple months ago. And it feels like forever ago. But go continue. Sorry.
There are so many developments being mm-hmm. tossed at us so quickly. It's hard to keep track of them all. But even that subtle nod towards Argentina could actually have been received negatively by our beef farmers in the country, right? Because, you know, thanks to the tariffs and all of that stuff going on last year, you had, you know, cattle ranchers and you had even your farmers, right? They had surpluses of their stock because they were unable to, you know, send that stuff abroad like they normally do. And so the mentioning of the beef prices and then that as a subtle nod to Argentina could actually have revived some of those negative feelings or those feelings of frustration that these folks in agriculture had felt at one point in time last year.
That would be interesting if the beef, because he listed off all these things where prices were down and then he mentioned the beef as an aside. So when we see this transcript of what he was supposed to say, I bet maybe beef wasn't in the, in yes. the speech. Another cost-related issue that came up last night was healthcare. So, and Trump and the Republicans in Congress and the Democrats have very different views on who is helping who with healthcare costs. President Trump called the Affordable Care Act the Unaffordable Care Act, and he said it is making insurance companies rich. And then in her Democratic response, Virginia Governor Abigail Spanberger said that recent legislation passed by Congress and signed by Trump has made it harder to afford healthcare.
They're making your life harder. They're making your life more expensive. They're even making it more difficult to see a doctor. Rural health clinics in Virginia and across the country are already closing their doors thanks to the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill, championed by the president and Republicans in Congress.
So this issue of rural hospitals losing money, because it is because of cuts to Medicaid. With less money in Medicaid, there's less money coming into rural hospitals, which have more patients on Medicaid. I've done more than one show about this and about the problem with rural health care here in Ohio. And soon access to care for thousands of people in rural Ohio is going to become harder. So, Paul Beck, what do you think will be the takeaway for Americans who are listening to that speech? Who is helping them with their health care?
Well, I think the takeaway will be, and we see it again in the polls, that people blame the Republicans for it. Now, the Republicans were very clever in how they crafted that legislation. Most of the cuts in health care, Medicaid in particular, come after now.
After 2028.
Come in 2028, mm-hmm. after the election.
Mm-hmm.
So people won't feel those directly. But rural hospitals in particular, and hospitals everywhere, will anticipate this and begin raising their prices. And, of course, everybody pays for these increased prices, because if you're taking people off of Medicaid and they go to the emergency room, somebody pays for that.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is who, and it's going to be people who have health insurance.
Mm.
And so the hospitals are going to respond, maybe not immediately, but at some point in the game. And so perhaps not by the time of the November elections will people be completely aware of what's going on there. But it's in the air. It's in the ether. It's mm-hmm. being talked about a lot. And I think it's going to be hard to dissuade most people from thinking that indeed healthcare costs are going to rise.
Yeah. Brianna, President Trump has worked to lower prescription drug prices. He is working on price transparency for how much things actually cost when it comes to healthcare. So he is doing some things. And I think the prescription drug costs, they're coming down faster. That's not a 2028 situation. That's a now situation. So do you think people will see if one of the drugs they take is cheaper, they're going to think that President Trump is doing something?
I think it would vary because, yes, I agree with you. On one end, prescription drug prices are coming down. But if you don't have the access to the medical professional to actually prescribe you the drugs that you need to get at a lower price, what is the point? Mm-hmm.
So what did you make of what was said in the Democratic response about healthcare versus what the president said in his speech? Because it was exact opposites.
When the governor was mentioning the lowered prices, but the issues that will arise as a result of the big, beautiful bill, the first thing that I thought about was the way in which the government shutdown ended, right? Mm. I forgot about that again.
Yeah. That was another one.
One of the reasons why the shutdown ultimately ended is because Democratic leaders agreed to table discussing the credits related to the Affordable Care Act. Mm. And, you know, it kind of been pushed away and talked away, and now here we are, right?
Yeah, the extensions of the discounts that some people were getting. Yes.
Yes.
That's not the right word. The subsidies. Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
And so once, you know, she was mentioning that, that was the first thing my brain went to. And all I could think about is, well, we wouldn't be here if there was a little bit more of a fight from our D.C. congressman. Mm.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about last night's State of the Union address with Brianna Mack, Associate Professor of Politics and Government from Ohio Wesleyan University, and Ohio State University Political Science Professor Emeritus Paul Beck. Last night, the president brought up data centers in his speech, too, and this is related to utility costs. Here is what he said about the future of data centers in America.
Many Americans are also concerned that energy demand from AI data centers could unfairly drive up their electric utility bills. Tonight, I'm pleased to announce that I have negotiated the new ratepayer protection pledge. You know what that is? We're telling the major tech companies that they have the obligation to provide for their own power needs. They can build their own power plants as part of their factory so that no one's prices will go up. And in many cases, prices of electricity will go down for the community and very substantially down. This is a unique strategy never used in this country before. We have an old grid. It could never handle the kind of numbers, the amount of electricity that's needed. So I'm telling them they can build their own plant. They're going to produce their own electricity.
So, Paul Beck, these data centers are popping up all over the place, all over central Ohio. Can we really get them to build their own power infrastructure?
Well, we don't know that yet. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is something that we will see in the future, maybe, but maybe not. And can that be handled or restrained through legislation? Again, that's unclear. The data center companies are not going to just sit there and take it. They're going to lobby against that kind of provision. So that was one of the few cases where it's a pie in the sky kind of pledge from the president. There's been very little action so far in the Congress in that direction. Some states are wrestling with that issue, not really successfully yet. Mm-hmm. So I think it's one of the things that he talks about happening in the future, hoping to happen in the future, but he needs congressional cooperation for that.
He talks about it like it's a done deal, but it's
exactly.
Definitely not. Okay, so Brianna, can he have it both ways? He wants chips to be built in the U.S. He wants us to stop relying on China for all of our future data needs, but he also wants the average American's electric bill to be down and not have to pay for these data centers. Can he do both?
I'm not sure. So when he introduced the ratepayer protection pledge, all that alliteration, the first thing I thought about was, so is he proposing two grids? Is our country going to have like two grids, one for the data centers and one for the regular people?
And, well, our grid's pretty old, so we need a new one. Sure, why not?
Then what about the quality of said energy? So like, will they have better energy and we will have the power grid that goes off if we just receive too much snow? And what will that look like?
Well, interesting. Yeah. Good.
I'm a bit skeptical.
You posed a great question. Now I'm like, what's the answer?
I don't know.
Great, great. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the State of the Union address from last night with Brianna Mack from Ohio Wesleyan University and Paul Beck from Ohio State University. So there were a number of Democrats who skipped the address last night. Among them, Congresswoman Joyce Beatty, U.S. Representative Chantel Brown of Warrensville. There were about 30 who skipped it. Paul Beck, is this new, skipping it altogether? I mean, do people skip it?
Yeah, I think occasionally they do. They often skip it for cause, things they disagree with. I noticed that only 4 of the 9 justices on the Supreme Court were there in attendance.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And that, I think, is different from the past. Not that every justice has shown up for the State of the Union address. I also noticed that he congratulated Justice Kavanaugh as he was walking in, but totally ignored Justice Coney Barrett, mm-hmm. of course, who had voted against his tariff policies. Mm-hmm. And that, I thought, was rather interesting because she, of course, was a Trump appointee. And he is obviously miffed with her, and that may continue over mm-hmm. time.
Brianna, what do you make of skipping it versus being in the room, you know, we'll use the phrase, in the room where it happens, to have the chance to stand up or not stand up or shout or clap, you know, that kind of thing?
I mean, I think it would have been worthwhile if more Democrats were in attendance. As we talked about earlier, when you look out in the audience, depending upon, you know, which channel you watch the address on, you could see the empty seats versus maybe not seeing the absent seats. And so while that was going on, I also thought it was very interesting with the Supreme Court justices that were there, that after he made that reference to them, how they all got up and left, which, you know,
they did. I was watching didn't show that. Okay.
Yeah. So like, they got up and left. And I thought that was also pretty interesting because I'd never seen that type of interaction before. Usually, if a president says something in reference to the Supreme Court that's a little bit negative, you know, they will pan over to the Supreme Court justices and you'll see them shake their head, yes or no. There'll be some sort of interaction. But to see individuals get up and leave, usually that's behavior for the congressman, not for a justice.
Normally, the justices just sit there and don't clap for anything. They just try to be neutral. Isn't that the way it's usually been, Paul Beck?
Yes, that's the way it usually has been. That's also true of the military officers who are there. And I wasn't watching them on everything, but the places where I did, aside from the awards that were given, which they applauded for, they by and large were stoic. And I think that's appropriate, actually. And it's very much in keeping with what's happened in the past.
Yeah, and for as far as the Democrats go, the ones who skipped it, the ones who were there, whenever they did stand up and applaud, they applauded the U.S. men's hockey team. They applauded some of the people who got awards, I feel like. But then they also applauded when he talked about the insider trading. And I thought, Brianna, I thought that was very interesting. And it was a nice little quip where he said he thought the Republicans wouldn't stand up for that. So what did you make of that little part of the speech?
I mean, I also clapped at home as if no one could hear me too. But I wonder the extent to which Congress will actually pass it. And then I also wonder the extent to which there will be loopholes or exceptions for people like himself and other folks that are connected to him. Because, you know,
so this is about elected members being in the stock exchange. Is that right? Is that what my understanding is?
That
correctly?
Was my understanding was too.
Okay. Okay. And from what I understand, President Trump himself says he's not in it. It's his family running his business. Is that correct, Paul?
That's correct.
Okay. So, but the channel I was watching, when this was discussed and when the standing and clapping happened, they zoomed right in on Elizabeth Warren for all of this discussion, right? Because this this is something she's been talking about for
that's
a long
time.
That's
been one of her themes for a long time. And I particularly flag that because that is something coming from Trump that is new. Whether he is going to turn to his fellow Republicans in Congress and say, you must pass some kind of controls on insider trading or not. We'll just have to wait and see. My guess is we'll never hear about it again, at least from Trump.
I was like, it would be fascinating if he actually asked Elizabeth Warren to draft the bill. Right?
Yes.
Fascinating. All right. Well, coming up, we're going to talk about voting, elections, and the reality TV style moments from last night's speech. And we'll discuss what it all means for Ohio in these upcoming midterm elections. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. The president promised a long State of the Union address because he said he had a lot to say, and he delivered. It was the longest State of the Union, clocking in at 1 hour and 47 minutes. Whether anyone was still awake to hear the 15-minute-long Democratic response remains to be seen. We're talking about the State of the Union address and how it sets the stage for the midterm elections. With us, we have Brianna Mack, Associate Professor of Politics and Government from Ohio Wesleyan University. Thanks again for being here.
Happy to be here.
And Paul Beck, Political Science Professor Emeritus from Ohio State University. Thanks again for being here.
Pleased to be with you, Amy.
So, Professor Mack, I saw in your bio that you teach a class on voting and elections in the U.S., and so I wanted to get your thoughts on this push that he made last night to pass the SAVE Act. It's a voting-related bill. SAVE stands for Safeguard American Voter Eligibility. It requires stricter requirements for the ID that you show when you register to vote and when you vote. What are your thoughts of what he said last night regarding passing the SAVE Act?
Well, so the way I've been framing the passage of the SAVE Act to my students is, of course, letting them know that they need to tell their mothers or anyone that had their name last names changed from their original name on their birth certificate, that they need to start getting that paperwork together now, because there is a really high chance that they will have problems trying to make sure that they can actually vote come November. And so
it's you need your birth certificate to vote or a passport.
Mm-hmm. However, if you're married and you took your husband's name or you changed your name from your maiden name, regardless of gender, right, that you need to make sure that the name that you have, you know, that there is, I think it's like some type of annotation that needs to appear on your birth certificate. It's like at the bottom that shows that you now go by this current name. Mm. Otherwise, they will say it's a fake, you know, fake identification, things of that sort. And so, you know, while there is this guise of, you know, passing this bill in order to have, quote unquote, safer elections, there is a maybe unintended consequence, it's intended, consequence of actually limiting access to the ballot. Hmm.
Well, and not everyone has a passport, too. So some people have to dig out the actual paper for your birth certificate. And oh my. Okay. So Paul Beck, Ohio has very secure elections. I mean, Ohio talks, you know, Secretary of State Frank LaRose and others talk about how proud they are of Ohio's elections. I believe Ohio has some of the strictest ID requirements in the country. So would this SAVE Act really be a huge change for Ohioans? Is it one step further?
It could be. It depends upon how the states handle it, states including Ohio. I'm not aware of anybody being questioned who comes to the polls with a name that was not on the name or was not the name on their birth certificate or maybe not even on their passport. It's a state enforcement issue. And I think we would have heard about that if it was a problem in some states. I think it would be a mess to enforce. Can you imagine, well, you don't know my wife, but can you imagine my wife reacting if they told her she couldn't vote after she's voted for 60 years with her...
With the last name Beck?
The last name Beck, yes. She also has a birth certificate that's in Spanish. And how,
well, that's complicated.
How that would, what kind of reaction that would get would be interesting. But I think the states, and I'll speak about Ohio in particular, I think we run very clean elections. And I've actually given talks to people who are election commissioners. And they're very professional, very concerned with making sure that all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed. And they're very resentful of this attempt to depict them in such a way that they are somehow allowing all this illegal voting to go on.
This is, he didn't actually say the words nationalize elections, which he has said, you know, it not in the State of the Union address. But this is a move to have a national rule, because for the most part, Brianna, each state does their own thing with elections, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I agree with Paul Beck. I've had election commissioners speak at our school and talk about, like, what happens after you submit your ballot. And they talk about, like, the security measures, how they have specific people that put their handprints on the doors. It's, like, really James Bond-esque type stuff to make sure that the ballots are protected and the counting is proper, all of these things. And so I would not be surprised if there were election officials last night listening to this talk and, yes, becoming angry, especially here in Ohio, knowing that, you know, we have some of the most accurate and most safe elections in this country.
He also brought up getting rid of mail-in voting. I mean, he listed a few certain circumstances where he still would allow mail-in voting. But Paul Beck, could you see mail-in voting going away?
I don't really think so. It's been a puzzle to me why not so much Trump is opposed to it. Mm-hmm. That is Trump, and it's his own reaction to electoral defeats or narrows that were much lower than margins that were much lower than he wanted. On the other hand, there's some states, particularly Western states, that either have only mail voting or in small counties allow those counties to opt out of actually having an election day itself and conduct all their balloting by mail. So I don't think that's really going to go anywhere, but it doesn't mean he will keep quiet about it.
In, Brianna, your students, I mean, do they, I maybe a lot of them are from Ohio and they can drive home to vote, but I bet some of them use mail-in.
Oh, yeah. So, like, I also oversee the voter registration drive at OWU. Mm-hmm. And so we're already thinking about ways to make sure that students, if they, you know, if voting mail-in ballots, if those requirements do change, like, how are we going to work around that to make sure students do have access to the ballots? And it could just be encouraging those students to go home or to look at when early voting starts and then go home.
Yeah, you're going to have to cancel class on that Tuesday to let them drive home.
I already canceled class on Tuesday.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about last night's State of the Union address with Brianna Mack, Associate Professor of Politics and Government at Ohio Wesleyan University, and Ohio State University Political Science Professor Emeritus Paul Beck. I wanted to talk for a moment about what, you know, former Senator Sherrod Brown sitting at home watching this speech, and then U.S. Senator John Husted sitting there, you know, at the speech last night. I assume he was there. I didn't see him on TV, but I'm assuming he was there. What are they thinking? The two of them are running against each other, Husted versus Brown, in this Senate race. And we all know that a lot of money is going to be poured into this race. Paul Beck, what are the two of them thinking as they listen to the speech regarding their race?
Well, I think they're thinking about what issues are going to be at play in the campaigns. Husted on the Republican side, thinking about, is there anything here that I can use to attack Sherrod Brown? And that will be, I think, control of the borders. Hmm. And it was one thing that Trump really didn't emphasize very much. He said it, but he didn't talk about what that meant. And so I think there's a vulnerability there for Democrats in terms of border control, particularly under the Biden administration.
Sherrod Brown was senator when the border was out of control.
That's correct.
Okay,
that's correct. Whether out of control is another matter. These are relative things, and it was under more control at certain points during the Biden administration, and other points not so much under control. So there's that. I think that Sherrod Brown is going to emphasize, as he always has, affordability, how the current economy hurts ordinary people. And Republicans, I think, are going to hope that there isn't really much talk about that during the campaign because they're very vulnerable on that point. So they're looking for those kinds of things. In Ohio, what's going to play in a major way here is corruption.
That's not what I thought you were going to say. Okay, tell me more.
Well, corruption coming from the Senate Bill 1 and the kinds of bribes that were used there where people have been convicted and are serving time in jail.
You mean House Bill 6?
House Bill 6, I'm sorry.
Okay,
yes.
Senate Bill 1 is the higher education bill.
Yes,
House Bill 6. Yes.
I lose track of the numbers.
That's okay. The first energy, the householder situation.
Right.
Let's call it
right.
that, yes.
Go. Yeah, that I think is going to be raised. Mm-hmm. I've already seen Senator Brown, ex-Senator Brown, make some mention of that. Husted is very vulnerable on that particular issue. And so we'll see how that plays out over time. Democrats, I think, would like to make use of this atmosphere of corruption that comes from the Epstein files, comes in a variety of other ways. How well that will play in Ohio, we don't know, but we've seen, you know, the criticism of Les Wexner on that. There's the Strauss issue here in Ohio as well, and that touches Wexner. So there are these kinds of things that I think will be in play in Ohio in a way that they might not be so much in play in other states.
All right, Brianna, what do you think about how things mentioned in the State of the Union Address or not mentioned, Epstein files being one, are going to play out in this midterm election year here in Ohio?
I feel like the Epstein files, while be good, I think it'll be a slippery slope in trying to see exactly like the connections between Les Wexner and others, because I remember seeing a headline saying that even Joyce Beatty had received a donation from Les Wexner. And of course, there is a lot of hoopla about that right now. And to my understanding, it seems like you can't play in Ohio politics without receiving some sort of support from Les Wexner. Mm-hmm. And so with that going on, I could actually see Sherrod Brown getting in trouble if he has received $5 or $6 from him as well.
So Sherrod Brown has, according to, we looked back to, I think, 2016, our reporter George Shilcock looked back, and Sherrod Brown has received money from Abigail Wexner, but not Les Wexner, according to what he was seeing. So just, you know, maybe prior to that, he looked back 10 years for the sake of argument at this time. So
there was Wexner family money.
Right. It depends on how you look at it, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt you. So what else do you think will play into Ohio politics besides the Epstein files?
I think also when we're thinking about the price of stuff, so I agree with the affordability argument as well. I also am curious about like the future deployment of ICE. And so, you know, after seeing what happened in Minneapolis, and we know that right now things in Springfield are kind of on a hold right now, but, you know, there's this expectation that, you know, ICE will eventually start, you know, their processes concerning the Haitians in Springfield. There is this concern that, you know, we will have our own version of Minneapolis. And if that happens, I know that would be absolutely catastrophic for Houston.
Yeah, that's true. Because, I mean, there's a lot of time between now and November, Paul Beck. So a lot of things can happen. You know, then the ICE situation,
yes.
I didn't even think about. Yeah.
Yeah. He made no mention of the ICE situation in Minneapolis and elsewhere, or made passing reference to Minnesota. It was
mostly
more
about
fraud.
Daycare fraud.
Yes, yes. So, if I were him, I would avoid that as well. Mm-hmm. That hasn't played well with the public. The other thing I wanted to mention, by the way, is that he really didn't talk very much about foreign affairs.
Yeah, it took him more than an hour to even bring up Iran, which a lot of pundits thought would come up much sooner since things are teetering with Iran. Yeah.
Well, it's a difficult issue for him because a lot of his base likes Trump and has liked the Trump presidency from before because he really wasn't putting troops on the ground and instead was withdrawing from those kinds of activities abroad. I don't see how Iran can be handled in the way that he wants to handle it without there being some kind of troops on the ground and without there being some deaths of Americans there. The Venezuelan situation is not just oil that has now been captured by the U.S., but it's what's going to happen on the streets of Caracas and elsewhere in Venezuela with a government that really is the Maduro government. And so I think there are things that are, I'll call them time bombs, that are there for the future, and he was wise, and his script writers were wise, not to put those kinds of things on the plate for him to talk about.
Well, and in 30 seconds we have left, he gave a big shout out to his Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, who is handling all of these foreign affairs. Marco Rubio looked a little tired.
It felt like 30 seconds, but it was probably closer to five. But Marco Rubio's face could tell, you know, a picture was worth a thousand words. Unhappy, tired. Maybe he's really frustrated because he is the one actually working behind the scenes trying to make sure we actually don't edge into World War III just yet.
Or maybe I was like, he was being a little shy. Everyone was clapping for him and he didn't stand up. You know, he just, I'm a bit tired.
He looked completely over it to me.
Well, and the backdrop here is that there is a very real competition between Marco Rubio on the one hand and J.D. Vance on the other hand for who will be the successor to Trump.
Really?
Has gotten a lot of positive play in recent weeks.
We'll leave it there. We've been talking about the State of the Union address with Paul Beck, political science professor emeritus from Ohio State University. Thanks for your time today.
Good to be here.
And Brianna Mack, associate professor of politics and government from Ohio Wesleyan University. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
This has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.